Okay, Toph. So, Erev Toph, it's great to see you all, and it's exciting to be here with you tonight to study together a very important and critical and pertinent topic of Jewish ethics in warfare. And I want to introduce our primary speaker tonight, Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Brody, and then I want to give a little bit of an intro before he starts his presentation. So, first of all, Rabbi Shlomo Brody comes with real expertise in this area. He's just about to publish a book on Jewish war ethics with Magid Press, and this is a topic he's been studying for a period of time now. He also has another book which I could strongly recommend. It's called A Guide to the Complex, which contains a summary of very complex halachic issues that Rabbi Brody has analyzed and studied. And right now, Rabbi Brody is the CEO. Rabbi Brody, you'll tell us the exact, a little bit more information about Ematai, which we see in the back of your screen. Rabbi Brody studied at Harvard University, Yeshivat Har Etzion, and just finished his PhD a few years back from Hebrew University. And I'll just say, from a personal standpoint, this is this is very exciting for me to be able to have this conversation. Rabbi Shlomo Brody. Rabbi Shlomo Brody, I met him first as Miles Brody. He was my matrich in Bnei Akiva, Kemo Shava, Ayo, hailing from Texas. And so this is wonderful to be able to have this conversation with an old matrich and someone whose articles I always enjoy reading and learning from. And so, in just a moment, Rabbi Brody's gonna get on and share a little bit about Ematai and also start his presentation for tonight. Before doing that, I also want to welcome, I know we have a number of guests tonight who are joining us from South Africa. Selwyn Smith wrote to me when he saw that I sent out this message, and he asked, can we join? Can we send this out to people in our community? And I said, absolutely. So we have a connection being made here between Jews here in Eretz Israel and in South Africa, and we're feeling the love, we're feeling the connection, and it means a lot to us that you're able to join for this as well. Now, there was one, someone did write to me today, and they questioned the appropriateness of having a discussion about Jewish war ethics while our chayalim are literally on the front lines, both in Gaza and in the north. And I do just want to address this point quickly because I think it's an important point. And while we discuss this topic, and to some degree, there's Torah study here, where we're fulfilling the mitzvah of Limud Torah. And that's always valuable at all times, especially during times of war. This is one of the things that we can do, even because we're not at the battlefront. And it's one way that we can support our chayalim. But there is, what I want to suggest is that as we study this topic, we're not studying as detached, an abstract topic. We're studying a topic which, unfortunately, is very relevant for us. And we're studying it, if you will, with a certain intentionality, with a hope that first of all, any study we do should be brings forth shmirah for our chayalim. We're studying to gain moral clarity, which is something that we always need. The world is certainly in need of moral clarity today. A lot of confusion about what's right and what's wrong, and our ability to both fight for goodness and also at the same time be critical and think at the same time and study Torah, come back to our sources and see what does the Torah say about some of these core questions. It's really important to be able to do that. Obviously, we're not sitting in judgment about what Israel is doing today. I've no doubt in my mind that Israel Tzahal is the most moral army to ever exist on the face of this earth. And so we're not sitting in judgment in any way of Israel's current policies. But we do want to understand, based on the sources, what does the Torah say about some of the critical issues of our day that we're addressing here in Israel? And that the world at large, is addressing with regards to war ethics. And obviously, we're going to bring a Jewish perspective to this. So va'anit tefillah, my hope, my prayer is that our chayalim should be protected, and that everything we do should be bizchutam and for their protection. And so, no further ado, I want to welcome our speaker tonight, Rabbi Shlomo Brody. He's going to present his topic for a certain 20, 25 minutes, 30 minutes. And then we're going to have a conversation, us two. And then we're going to open this to everyone to be able to ask questions. Okay, so I'm going to spotlight for everyone our two screens. And you know what? I'll keep Rabbi Brody. You'll just stay on for now because I know you have a presentation. And then when I join for the conversation, I'll spotlight as well. So bechavod, Rabbi Brody, it's great to have you here at Kilat Shiftei
Okay, thank you
Yisrael.
so much. It's good to be here with you, and thanks for outing my English name. It's always good to have that out in the open, but it's nice to see an old friend as well. And it is a great zchut, to learn Torah together as a community, and think about some profound issues. And I certainly think that there's a great importance, dafka, precisely when we're in the midst of these types of moments, to gain a certain amount of moral clarity here. Not only about why we're fighting, but how we're fighting. And I think it's particularly important right now because, given what's happened in the past, and you can already see signs from around the world, we're going to need a lot of moral fortitude, physical fortitude, of course, to continue fighting right now, and moral fortitude, to fight right now. And therefore, it's really, really important for us to have an understanding of why we're fighting and how we're fighting, which is really going to be more the focus today. In general, military ethics, what's known as just war theory, is usually divided into two types of ideas. One relates to what justifies going to war in the first place, and the second issue relates to why, excuse me, how we fight in war, right? The ethics of fighting in war. In our case right now, I don't think there are too many people that are questioning why we went to war, right? Why we've responded with war against Hamas. The argument for self-defense here is really, really clear. But the bigger issue, of course, that's going comes up and is going to continue coming up, and particularly with regard to the CNN effect, so-called CNN effect. That is to say, given all the images that come out from Gaza, which seems to see show a lot of destruction and suffering, the question always becomes how we're fighting and how we're fighting ethically. And so I do think that this is a matter of crucial importance. As Rabbi Ben David mentioned, I just coming out with a book now. It's off to the printers already. I put in the chat. We had hoped it'd be out already, and we're rushing as much as we can. And the iPad, ver the Kindle version, will be ready soon enough. But it is certainly something that I've been thinking about for quite some time. And I look forward to discussing a little bit of a taste of that with you this evening. Okay, so I want to begin. Let me just start to share my screen here. I want to begin. This is good. I want to begin actually tonight with a different story, not of Gaza 2023, but of the siege of Beirut in July 1982. And I'm starting with this in part because of all the discussion about siege warfare right now in Gaza. Israel isn't actually imposing a siege. There's certainly an element of a blockade, there's certainly an element of limitation. This isn't a formal siege per se. There's stuff going in, maybe going out as well, a few people going out. We're, of course, also don't control all the borders here. One side, of course, is controlled by Egypt. So it's a little bit complex to call this, technically speaking, a siege, but the issues of siege warfare bring up a lot of different issues. And as you know, people were saying that siege warfare causes everyone in Gaza to suffer, and not just, of course, the Hamas fighters, but probably even more primarily the non-combatants, the civilians, because as we know, this is generally true, besieged forces always make sure that their forces get the supplies they need to fight. And so the people that are going to be most impacted by a formal siege are usually going to be, at least initially, the non-combatants. And this issue of siege warfare really came up in an acute manner for the first time in Israeli military ethics in Beirut in 1982. You recall that in June 1982, Israel begins what then is known as Operation the Peace of Galilee, but later is known as the First Lebanon War, and then later on the First Lebanon War. And a month later, after a lot of treacherous warfare, urban warfare in many ways, going up the Lebanese coast and through the Lebanese countryside, Israel makes it to Beirut and puts a siege around Beirut. And here's a picture of a proper siege in different directions. And at that time, the man in the bottom right corner, probably the most famous military rabbi in Israel's history, maybe in Jewish history, Rabbi Shlomo Goren, who by then is the chief Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Israel, though of course previously he was the chief rabbi of the army. He famously blows the shofar at the Kotel in 1967, and Rabbi Goren drops his own ethical bombshell, if you will. And Rabbi Goren declares that Jewish ethics mandate that our siege is not hermetic. It mandates that there has to be a fourth side open, so to speak, and allowing people to flee the combat zone, to flee the siege. Now, of course, if you keep one side open, it's not much of a siege. Now, he means that it should be a one-way, right, corridor, meaning that people should be able to leave, but he's very insistent that Jewish law demands for us to keep the fourth side open. And this causes a bit of a brouhaha. There's articles in the newspaper about it, it's talking about it. Now, of course, Saul's not taking commands from the chief rabbi, but he's a major public intellectual figure, if you will. And there's some attention drawn to his statement, particularly because of his strong military history. And one of those who oppose him is the man on the upper right, Rabbi Shaul Israeli, chief rabbi of Yeshivat Merkaz HaRav, one of the very critical figures in the religious Zionist world. And Rabbi Israeli argues and says there's no such requirement in Jewish law, and certainly not in case of a milchemet mitzvah, in a mandated war that's meant for self-defense, and certainly in the territory of Eretz Israel. And Rabbi Israeli says Rabbi Goren's got this all wrong. Okay, now, why do I start with this? Well, in part, of course, because of the question of the siege right now, but because I think that the first Lebanon War was the first war in which Israel really had to confront issues of urban warfare and civilian casualties. Right now, it is true that 56 and 67 and 73, there were occasions there's no such thing as a perfectly sealed off battlefield. Civilians are always caught up in one form or another in wars. But nonetheless, the battlefields were more demarcated in the earlier wars, whereas in 82, when we're fighting against the terrorist group, the PLO, right, Yasser Arafat, we're fighting asymmetric warfare, which is a term we're more familiar with today, but was something which was really getting conscious of people from the Israeli experience. So Israel is certainly dealing with and grappling with this issue of fighting in the midst of civilians. And part of the significance of Rav Goren's statement was precisely on this issue, to state that Judaism mandates we let some of these people flee. Now, that is a value I'm going to argue tonight, but I want you to know that I think there are many, many different values. Okay? And in general, when it comes to Jewish military ethics, obviously I'm not going to develop this all tonight, but I think that if when I mention some of these ideas, you'll understand intuitively where some of these come from. On the one hand, it's certainly true we care about the dignity of mankind. All humans created in the image of God, which is one of the reasons, not the primary reason, why we believe in the inherent wrong of illicit bloodshed, of lo tirzach, of not murdering. And on a related note, when we do kill, we wanted to kill, right? We want to hold those who do something bad responsible. And our belief is that when there's licit bloodshed, we should only try to kill those who are actually responsible, right? The notion of individual responsibility, as the Yechezkel teaches us, right? And the Durham teaches us, we have these notions of saying we just want to kill only those who are responsible, only those who have sinned. Part and parcel, of course, in the Jewish vision is that there is world peace. We'll come back to this momentarily. And by the way, friends, I remind myself of this all the time right now, because more than ever, we need to remember that there is a rainbow at the end of the flood, right? That there is hope for a better future. Because if we didn't believe that, friends, I don't know why we keep on going on. And so it is important to keep that in mind always, that we have a vision of world peace. Having said that, and here I want to come back and see some of our sources, it is clear that the Bible understands that there is a notion of mandated warfare, and warfare is important. Sorry, let me just pull it back up. And where I want to see that, of course, is we know that in Sefer Yeshayahu, where we have this famous pasuk of the dream of peace, right? Here's the UN wall on the left. Same psukim are quoted in Micha, but note in the same parak in Micha, parak Dalet there, when we talk about this idea of beating the swords into plowshares, et cetera, we also are told, "For I will give you horns of iron and provide you with hooves of bronze, and you will crush the many people." Meaning right there and then, in the moment when we're talking about the vision of world peace, we also understand that there's a reality of warfare, and that warfare is necessary for bringing justice into the world, right? We see this. We're told, right, when I don't want to, I purposely don't want to get into questions of Amalek tonight because Amalek doesn't exist anymore. And it's a different shear in its own right. Maybe we'll talk about this later on, maybe Rabbi Ben David, I see you smiling already. But nonetheless, the notion of saying that there is evil in this world and that evil needs to be destroyed from this world is a very, very important principle. And particularly in our world today, it's important to remember that sometimes there's evil and evildoers, and that needs to be destroyed. And which is why God tells us, Dvarim, right? 20th chapter of Dvarim, right? Tells us, right? When you're in war, right? Be courageous, be brave, do not fear. Right? This is a very, very important part of our vision. And so it's important to recognize the fact that while we do believe, right, in the vision of world peace, we understand that warfare is going to be necessary for pursuing justice. And here, perhaps most importantly for our purposes right now, warfare by its nature is a collective affair, right? We care, like Rabbi Ben David was talking about beforehand, we care about our side. Why do we care about our side? Because we recognize while we believe in individual responsibility, nonetheless, right, warfare by its nature is a collective affair. We have nations against nations, and we are going to have a partiality to our own people. Okay? That is a crucial factor here, and I think a moral factor. I don't only say this as a human factor, I mean, that's a moral value that we understand that we have a what you might call associative commitments. By the fact that people are comrades, our community, our nation, our family, we have a greater moral obligation to them. And so when you put all this together, one of the key factors when thinking about Jewish military ethics is you're going to have a lot of different values that you're going to be, and if you look at this list, in fact, I think all of us would recognize, yeah, a lot of these make sense. The question is, which ones take priority? And the answer in my mind is that all these values need to be brought to the table. And so the question is always going to be is in a given circumstance or in a general picture, right, which ones are going to take priority or trump others? But we should never forget these different values. I stress this for two reasons. One of which is that many times you'll hear today, oh, look at the pictures. The pictures are terrible, right? Humanity, this is not humanistic, whatever it might be. Now, of course, that is a value that all human beings are created in the image of God, but it's not the only value. And the same way I say back to people who say the only value here is we win. The only value is that our team wins. Okay. I think it's a primary value to win. I think it's very important, but it doesn't mean that there aren't other values in the picture. And so one of the challenges is always going to be how do we balance keeping these values together? And I think the issue of siege warfare, which we began with in 1982, but I think the issue of siege warfare is particularly indicative of this attempt to bring multiple values to the table, as I'm going to try to show you now. Siege warfare is something which exists, right, very early on in the history of the Jewish people. We know Chazak Ve'Amatz, Yoshua. We know that Yoshua does multiple sieges when he conquers Eretz Yisrael. And the most explicit statement in the Torah about any limits on warfare comes in the context of discussing a siege. When you're war against a city, you have to besiege it a long time in order to capture it. you must not destroy its trees. In other words, this whole notion of, which is a very important principle in general, right, of saying that we're not going to leave behind, right, we're not going to burn down the cities, right, is a very important notion. And it's precisely in the context of sieges where this comes up. But I think sieges have a even greater significance for us. And it's not just in the stories of how when the Jews lay a siege, and certainly we do lay sieges in Tanakh, it's also how we suffered under sieges. Now, this is something to keep in mind in the back of your mind. Remember Tisha B'Av time, but you'll notice that when you look at the stories of the Churban by Rishon, by Sheni, and other bad affairs, including Beitar, the fall of Beitar, and antiquity, sieges play a large role. In fact, we have a number of fast days that relate to Churban HaBayit, and one of them is Asara B'Tevet, right? The 10th of Tevet. What do we commemorate on the 10th of Tevet? The beginning of the siege. Beginning of the siege. Who cares about the beginning of the siege? We just care about the end of the siege, when they break the walls, Shemesh HaTamuz, and destroy the temple, Beit HaMikdash, Tisha B'Av. And yet, we created a fast day because the siege is precisely the terror on the people, right? The suffering that goes on to the people, which is predicted in Sefer Yechezkel, amongst other places, and then comes to fruition in our story. So if you look in Eicha Perek Daled, you see here the description, right, of the poor people who've turned cruel, right, because they're so hungry, they have no food, right? The tongue of the sucking cleaves to its palate for thirst. Little children beg for bread, but no one gives them a morsel. The wealthy now are just digging or lying dead in the refuse heaps. Their bodies are blacker than soot. You can't even recognize people's faces anymore. That's how horrible it is. Their skin has shriveled on their bones to the point where we say it was better off those who were slain of the sword, meaning those who were killed by battle, than those slain by famine. And then, of course, we have the heart-wrenching stories of women, mothers, killing and cooking their own children in order to eat. Okay? Sieges are brutal. It's something, and if you look carefully in the keynote, if you look in Eicha and other places, you see this. And by the way, it's not just by Rishon. We have similar stories that we'll get into now, and by Sheni. And it's very interesting when we read about who's responsible for this suffering. So in the book of Josephus, he tells us a story, a similar type of story, of a woman who kills and cooks her child. And the Roman soldiers, when they hear about this, are, right, horrified, some of them. And some of them, Josephus tells us, pity the distress which the Jews were under. But there are many of them who didn't care, right, because they just have such a bitter hatred against the Jews. And then you have the rationale of Caesar. What does Caesar say? Caesar, he excused himself before God as to this matter and said the following. He had proposed peace and liberty to the Jews, as well as an oblivion of all of their former insolent practices, but they instead chose sedition, and instead of peace, war, and before satiety and abundance, a famine. What is Caesar's argument? I didn't force them to go to war. They could have said, all right, we're outnumbered here. We'll surrender. And they could have stayed alive and not starved to death. Meaning, once you offer war, right, once you offer peace and they don't accept it, all's fair in love and war. And that's precisely what Caesar is arguing. Caesar is saying they have the choice once the battle begins. This is their responsibility. And therefore, we, meaning the Romans here, have no responsibility for the suffering of the Jewish people, fighters and non-fighters alike. Now, I wonder, is that true in Jewish thought? That once the war starts, we have no responsibility for the fate of the fighters and non-fighters alike. And I think the answer is complicated, but it's actually clear that that is not true. And this comes to a couple of very important passages. Passage number one is the pasuk in Devarim, which tells us that you should offer a town to come to attack it, terms of peace. And the Rambam brings this down in Hilchot Lachem as well. Interesting enough, he says this is true for both the Milchemet Rishut and the Milchemet Mitzvah. We always have to offer peace. The Ramban agrees with him. Not everyone agrees to him. This is an interesting question. I won't get stuck in this right now, but it's important to note that the Rambam thinks you always have, and the Ramban thinks you always have to offer peace. Now, where did this idea come from?
Rabbi Brody, if you don't mind, just quickly, just explain to everyone the difference between Milchemet Rishut and Milchemet Mitzvah.
Sure. So I don't want to get too caught up with this, but a Mechemet Mitzvah is a war that is done against the seven Canaanite nations, a war of against the Amalek, or a war of self-defense, at least in the Rambam's terminology. And so it's a bit surprising that a mandated war, a commanded war, would say, but before you go about doing that, you should go and offer peace. Because you could say we only offer that what's known as a Milchemet Rishut, which for our purposes right now we'll define as an imperial war, a war that's meant to expand our borders. So you could say, instead of going to war to expand your borders, offer some form of peace and make them subject to your rule without killing them. But you wouldn't think that would be true about conquering the Holy Land, but the Rambam says, yes, this is true. No matter what type of war you go to, you always offer peace. Is that good, Rabbi Ben David? Okay, so where did this idea come from that we always should offer peace? So according to the Medrash, we are told that it comes from a very interesting dialogue between God and Moshe. God says to Moshe, you should utterly destroy them. Acharem tacharem, right? Get rid of them. And Moshe says back to God, I'm not going to do this. And he says, how can I go and smite them? I do not know who has sinned and who has not sinned. What's Moshe saying? I don't want to go and destroy everyone when some of these people have done no wrongs to me. And so, in order to avoid that type of scenario, Moshe says, okay, let's go to peace. And according to the Medrash, God agrees with him. Meaning, according to the Medrash, this recognition of the fact that there might be people who are not worthy of being killed exists before we go to war, and therefore do not, right, go to war without offering peace, because we really don't want to kill those people who aren't sinning against us. But what about if they say no to peace and war begins? Do we then say it doesn't matter whether they've sinned against us or not sinned against us? We kill them all anyway. And here, my friends, comes back to this law of the sieges. And here we get to a very, very interesting statement, a midrash, a halachic midrash, in which they discuss the war against Midian. Now, I don't want to get too caught up with this, but let me just mention the war against Midian is the last place in the world you would expect limits on military efforts, right? Last place in the world you expect military ethics, because we're told about Midbar Lamed Aleph that when they go and attack Midian and kill all of the adult males, and they come back home and they bring the women and the children and all the booty and say, look, Moshe, look what we did. And Moshe says to them, you kept these women alive, you kept the male children alive, kill them all. So that would be the least, at the place I least expect to find statements of moral limitations on warfare. And yet, here we have on the left side a very interesting discussion. When they warred against Midian, the Chachamim say they surrounded it from four sides. Okay, meaning that's how you do a siege, right? The regular way to do a siege, you on four sides. But Rabbi Natan, 2nd century CE, right, Tana says they left a fourth side for them to flee from. Rabbi Natan says, no. When they went against war against Midian, they left a fourth side open. There's no indication of this in the text of the Torah at all. But that, nonetheless, Rabbi Natan says this. And what's fascinating is, even though it might go against the position of the Chachamim here, both the Rambam and the Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, rule Like Rabbi Natan, when a siege is placed around a city to conquer it, it should not be strong on all four sides, only on three, Maimonides says. And he further explains, a place should be left for the inhabitants to flee and for all those who desire to escape with their lives. Okay, very important. You need to allow these people to escape with their lives. Precisely what Caesar had no interest in doing, Rabbi Natan, followed by the Rambam and Ramban, say, even once the war has begun, let the people flee if they want to escape with their lives. Now, where do we get this from? So the Rambam says, Mipia Shmua, it's a tradition because it's nowhere in the text. But what's interesting is that some of the other commentators give an explanation. And for example, if you look at the Ramban, so when he explains this law, so he says the following, we are commanded when we lay a siege on the city to leave one direction open so if they want to flee, they can do so. From this, he gives two explanations. From this, we learn to act with compassion, even toward our enemies at the time of war. Meaning, even when in the midst of war, show a little bit of compassion. We don't want to kill everyone. And he points out it has a strategic advantage that allows an opening to flee as opposed to strengthening their efforts against us. Let's think about this for a moment, friends. If you lay a siege on a city and they've got nowhere to go, what are the people going to do? They're going to fight because there's nothing else to do. But if you allow them to flee for their lives, what might they do? Run away. And if they run away, it's going to be a lot easier to conquer that city. So there's a strategic value to that as well. I did find
just to add in a small anecdote. Joe Biden, you know, he's met every prime minister dating back to Golda Meir. And he always shares the story that she told him that, you know, one of our advantages is that we have nowhere else to go. You know, so there is an element of we're stuck. There's nowhere to run to. That's it. Eretz Yisrael or else, you know, and that strengthens our fortitude to fight and our resolve to fight.
It could be. Absolutely. Right. It could be. And so partly there's a strategic element here. And I did find actually that there are a couple of Roman writers who say the same thing in the second century. First and second century, it's not the majority position. Most Roman strategists said that, no, you know, you just close them down and starve them to death. But this notion does exist elsewhere. And maybe that's where Rabbi Natan even got the idea from. But I don't think so. I think if you look at others, they're commentators. So here I have the Meshech Chachma of Simcha Kona Dubinsk, who says that the Ramban got this idea from the notion of offering peace. The fact that we saw beforehand, right, that we would offer peace because we want to avoid killing those who have not sinned is precisely the same reason why we leave a fourth side open. Meaning there's a notion of saying that even when you're in the midst of war and you want to win the war and you want to fight strong and you want to fight in a way that protects your own soldiers, all of these are values, my friends. There's no doubt about it. But nonetheless, when you can, let those want to flee, flee. Right? There is a notion of having mercy, even in the context of a war which you want to win and want to kill a lot of people. So let's go back to our first question. Who did the idea follow in 1982? Rabbi Goren or Rabbi Israeli? Rabbi Goren says, leave the fourth side open. Rabbi Israeli says, what kind of siege is that? And the answer, my friends, is Rabbi Goren. Right. The Israel did lay a siege, but did leave a corridor out, which allowed approximately, we think, about 100,000 people to flee Beirut. And look at the end result on the right side here. You will see that now the 14,000 PLO terrorists leave Beirut. Now, it's believed that during the war, 1,000 PLO fighters died during the siege, excuse me. And we think about 5,000 non-combatants were killed, another 20,000 to 30,000 wounded. The numbers here are a little bit hard to know because the head of the Lebanese Red Cross was Yasser Arafat's brother. And so let's just say he wasn't seen as a most reputable source for all of the numbers. But if you look at some of the outside assessments of what happened in that war. And frankly, you'll see this in many subsequent wars as well. You will see that many have noted the idea that this is not excessive civilian casualties at all, given right, the fact that we were fighting amongst the civilian population. So we have a lawyer here who's writing in 1987. She actually works for the International Red Cross, International Committee of the Red Cross, who wrote and said the bombardment of Beirut resulted in high civilian casualties, but not necessarily excessively so, meaning it was reasonable. And not only is it reasonable, if you look at two American, non-Jewish military historians, Trevor Dupuy and Paul Martrell in their book, Flawed Victory, they describe as military historians, we can think of no war in which greater military advantages were gained in combat in densely populated areas at such a small cost in civilian lives lost and property damaged. And this despite the PLO's deliberate emplacement of weapons in civilian communities. What I'm trying to show you right now is that the phenomenon of trying to minimize civilian casualties, Israel has been doing, continues to do, and has done it, I believe, in the spirit of this law, in the spirit of this rule of the fourth side open of the siege, where we do believe we want to win. We want to win well. We want to kill all the bad guys. We want to uproot evil. We want to protect our own. And as much as possible, we should try to minimize the deaths of non-combatants on the other side. Now, friends, this is a complicated principle to implement. How complicated is it? So the first siege in the first Lebanon War was in 1982 in Beirut. And the end was a negotiation. Arafat and 14,000 PLO fighters head off to Libya, and Israel thinks they're in a better place. There's a long story here what happens. And in 1983, Arafat and his henchmen come back to Lebanon. And so Israel lays the siege on Tripoli. And so Israel is laying a siege there. And at that point, one side actually is not sieged by Israel. It's by the PLO's internal opponents within the Arab world. And Rav Gorin comes out once again and says, do not let any single person out. There is no obligation to leave a fourth side open. And everyone's like, huh? Last year, you had a whole fight with Rav Yisraeli. And then the essay writes in 83, he starts giving the same arguments Rav Yisraeli gave. And people are like, wait a minute. Now, there's a technical explanation here of why you might not think that there's a need to give a fourth side open here. And it could be A, because Israel didn't fully have control of the siege. One side was controlled by PLO enemies. And it could also be that, you know, you get one chance to flee the siege. But if you left and then come back, we're not going to let you flee again. It could be that's a technical argument. But I think Rav Gorin gets a little bit stuck on this issue because he thought it was a bona fide law. And I don't think this is a bona fide law. And this is exactly what Israeli started pushing back on. But the notion of the fourth side open of Rabbi Natan, I believe, right, is a principle. It's a principle, it's a value, it's one of those values which we need to take into consideration. But like I said beforehand, there are more than one values and principles that always need to be taken into consideration. And so part of the challenge here is recognizing that reducing civilian casualties is a value, but it's not the only value. And part of the goal is to try to retain all these values at once when you're fighting against a very vicious enemy. And I'll conclude with the following thought, which is that, you know, I don't know if there's an exact formula. I don't think there's an exact formula on how always to fight and to fight well and nobly and to win and to fight ethically. But I do believe that those who keep in mind these types of values, those who keep in mind, recognize the fact that there are multiple values at play here, and that we're going to try to keep them always in our consideration, those are going to be the most ethical armies. And God should bless our soldiers for maintaining these values, and God should protect our soldiers and our people, and we should have a very strong and quick victory against Hamas. Rabbi Ben David.
Okay. But Bertie, thank you for giving us a general outline of these core issues in this particular halakha, the Rambam versus the Ramban. First of all, just want to mention the, to focus on for a second, the Meshech Chochma points out that for the Rambam, and to some degree you mentioned this, but the notion of having a fourth, a fourth side open is not for humanitarian reasons. It's strictly for strategic reasons that you let out all of the bad guys, or and anyone who they did this way, they won't really fight against you with the same, resilience. In which case, I mean, this Rambam is really just giving us military strategy. It's not really providing us any ethical impairment.
So yes, there's a great debate about the commentators. You can see here actually the Radbaz thinks this is all about Darchei Torah v'chon livdei shalom, whereas the Meshech Chochma thinks this is a matter of strategy. And I think the answer myself is that there's multiple factors here at play. I don't think we have to limit to one or the other. But yes, you were right. That's certainly one way to read it.
Would no, but let's get back to this. How do we sort of apply what happened then a little bit to our situation right now? If Israel continues to, let's say, go easy on what's happening on Hamas, Chas v'Shalom, what happened just a month ago, lo aleinu, could happen again. So are we? Is one ultimately like the value of self-defense? I noticed you had nine principles of there. Where does self-defense, sort of come in there? Was that justice under warfare? I mean, does it mean by fighting against, by allowing all these soldiers, the enemy to get out, you're in the end not protecting your own people? Where's the balance? Where's the right balance here?
Right, so it's not self-defense is obviously the reason why we're going to war in the first place, right? So that's always, I mean, that's my assumption here. That's a overarching goal here, of course. But I don't think that these are necessarily, a contradiction in the following sense. We're not looking, right, to have a situation where people flee and then just come back to kill us, right? In other words, it takes applied to our time. If we would suddenly say, okay, well, let's have a ceasefire, we'll allow the leaders of Hamas to go off to Libya or to Lebanon or somewhere else, whatever. We'll get back our hostages and that'll be it. But then they come back 2 years from now. That's not a plan here. All right. So there is this balance, and that's why I'm trying to say that. I don't want mean to say that there's an absolute requirement, like a law, that you have to have the fourth side open. I don't mean in a literal sense. And that's exactly what happened with Gorin in Tripoli, right? When you realize, okay, we really can't have this as a literal requirement. But at least to recognize the fact that those who haven't sinned against us, for both strategic reasons and inherent reasons, we have no interest in killing. And the big ramification of that is just we should target always combatants. That's who we're fighting against.
To actually bring in Rav Nachum Eliezer Rabinovich, who was a commentary on the Rambam's Mishneh Torah, he points out in his Yad Pshuta that when the Rambam says that you allow a space open laboreach ulemishu atzeli himaleta, he said it doesn't mean ein lasot petach gadol. You're not making this huge opening, keeping open, sheyefshar lashkiach alav, ela katan, a small opening that people can run away, but obviously not to bring in supplies, equipment, etc. This is his own diuk in the Rambam's language.
Rav Gorn agrees with it. Rav Gorn agrees with it. He says, and this narrow corridor that Israel is trying to allow people from the north to go to the south, I think is, it's for strategic reasons as well. We wanted to get the non-combatants out of there, so it's a lot easier to fight the combatants there. But it's also.
And the irony in this war is that they want the civilians, the non-combatants, to stay in because this is their whole methodology of making it harder for us to fight.
Right. And I do believe, I actually published an article today in Sapir, I'll try to share it, but I do believe that the fact that the other side doesn't care matters, meaning reciprocity or the lack of reciprocity matters. And so one of the big questions that comes up here is, well, how much do we have to take into account proportionality and how much of the collateral damage? And when the other side is the cause for greater civilian deaths because they don't care. Well, then we could be a little bit more looser in the proportionality requirements, in my mind. And so it's more than just ironic, it's tragic as well. And that's something we have to, I think, recognize, so it's important.
Yeah, but I want to come back to a point that you made earlier, that when you said that Amalek doesn't exist anymore. If Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, if they are not Amalek, then who is Amalek? And if we're talking about Amalek, of course, we know the halakha about Amalek is that everyone needs to be destroyed. Okay, Amalek. Why are we not? Why don't you think we're talking about a category of Amalek right now?
So, let's keep in mind there are two different elements of Amalek. One element is evil, pure evil, even. And in this respect, I don't have a problem saying that Hamas or Hezbollah or others that we fought against have those types of Amalek-like qualities. And therefore, they need to be uprooted from this world. I mean, those qualities to be approved from this world. And if you look by the cover of Commentary Magazine this month, actually has a picture of the fighting, and it quotes the verses from right this notion of uprooting Amalek from this world. So that I don't have a problem of saying. I do think that we have many reasons why we don't want to fight Amalek, right? Fight Hamas the same way we're commanded to fight Amalek by committing genocide. I don't think we want that for our soldiers. I don't think we want it for our people. I don't think it's necessary either. And so, in that respect, I think it's dangerous to invoke it. And since you mentioned Rav Rabinovich, there's this drasha that Rav Soloveitchik gave in 1954 called the Didufek. And he quotes his father, who says that, Nasser today is the Nazis, and Nasser are the new Amalek. And a lot of people generally don't like quoting Rav Soloveitchik because he was in favor of land for peace and negotiating this or that, but they love to quote this passage. And what's interesting is that Rav Rabinovich, in his Yad Pshuta, right, in his Sefer,
Also Melamdei Mochama is
correct,
Shutiran.
correct, in both places, quotes from Rav Shila, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook, who says, "Nah, this isn't true. There's no such thing as Amalek. Amalek was a very specific people. We don't have a mitzvah of Amalek today, but I do think we do have the mitzvah of uprooting evil." And so, again, we're trying to, you might say, thread the needle here, but I think it's trying to balance the different values at play.
Interesting. And the Rav Soloveitchik was basing this on the fact that the Rambam says that the seven nations don't exist anymore, the Shivat Amamim, but he doesn't say the same thing about Amalek. And from this, he extrapolates, oh, Amalek must still exist. Now, how do they exist? No one has ever met an Amalekite. So they exist as an idea, as an ideology, as the abominate evil itself. And that's how we applied it, nachon, to the Nazis and to Nasser. And it is interesting, Rav Rabinovich, who was quite right wing in his worldview, certainly felt that this was not an accurate reading of the Rambam, and that Amalek no longer exists as far as we know, and so you can't apply that category. But it is what you're saying is really important, that we have to be careful with our terminology. When you throw out, oh, they're Amalek or this or that, well, there, you have to follow up with what you say and how you categorize this.
Yeah, no, we have to be
It's
super careful
important.
about this. And I'll mention another thing that I'm not interested in vengeance or revenge. Galant, I need right now. Right? I'm not giving right out this that, but Galant, one of his first speeches, the defense minister, said we're going to avenge these deaths and whatnot. And again, I understand the emotions here, but that's not what we're looking for. We're looking for security and justice. And so it's very important for us to stay focused on achieving those goals and tempering the obvious emotions of the moment in order to make sure we fight wisely and well. And vengeance is not usually a good way to fight wisely.
Well, what do we say on Wednesday? We're going to say in the Shir Shalyom, which the Levim sang in the Beit HaMikdash, El Nekamot Hashem, El Nekamot Tefiah. Hashem is the one who does vengeance. God, this isn't your domain. We fight for justice, as you said, for peace, Hashem, but you take vengeance upon our enemies.
That's right. Hashem Yikom Domo. I totally believe that. I want it, but I don't want to fight that way. Meaning, and let me just be clear here. The way that I'm proposing to fight is going to kill a lot of people. And let's just be realistic here, right? Even if you're targeting combatants, and I think it's very important. And even if you're going to say we should try to allow others to flee, at the end of the day, a lot of people are going to die here, combatants and non-combatants alike. And we should recognize the fact that this is going to be, I'm far from being pacifistic about this, right? In other words, there is something that's going to be very important here to fight, but I do think that we should always keep this in mind that when possible, we want to minimize the damage to non-combatants.
Yeah. What do you think about some people have been throwing around the term, this is Nazism, and I think Netanyahu even said today we have to denazify, the area of Gaza. Do you see that as being a helpful and productive term, or does that also get us into problematic territory, just like Amalek?
Well, there's a little bit of it's a little bit complicated because in the world's eyes, it simplifies things. When you say they're the Nazis or they're ISIS, right, they're whatever it is. And the truth is what happened on October 7th certainly evoked, for good reasons, Nazi-type behavior. I mean, I actually really dislike comparisons to Nazi Germany, to the 30s. I think it's totally overused, these comparisons. But if you're going to make one comparison, tragically, right, there is something to say for that. And I don't have a, I think that there's a value to that in the following sense, that just as during World War II, it was understood that we need to utterly defeat the Nazis, that some form of negotiated surrender wasn't going to be acceptable, so to hear that there's a value to that. But once again, we have technology and the means today to fight differently than we fought in World War II. And this is an important point because World War II, we did a lot of aerial bombing, wasn't particularly accurate, and this wasn't precision bombing at all. But today we have the ability to do much more precision bombing, and so we should try to do precision bombing when possible. At the same time, and I think this is already going to come up, and it's going to certainly come up when we move to South Gaza, we need to prioritize our soldiers and our people. And so when push comes to shove, and if we have a decision to make, do we overly risk our soldiers? Or do we say, well, we're going to bring in the artillery or the airplanes, whatever it is, and shoot at three targets, one of which has terrorists in it, two of which don't, but we don't know which one it is? I think the answer needs to be that we have to protect our soldiers. And so that is an important value. And again, trying to balance things. And in that respect, the comparison to fighting the Nazis or the importance of defeating the Nazis is relevant here.
I mean, would you say your view on that has shifted in terms of the risks that we should be willing to take in this war versus, the last few years? Has something shifted for you in terms of your unwillingness to risk Israeli lives at this point in time?
No, but that's partly because, I've been writing this book and thinking about this a lot. I think it's become easier for some people because now that we see how horrific Hamas is, it's become easier for people to say that you can't, there's no messing around here. But, we're going to have to do, once this war is over, there's going to be a lot of accounting, right? Cheshbon ha-nefesh about the mechadal, so to speak, that's going on. And I think we're going to have to do a moral accounting, which goes something like this. Why did we think it was acceptable to have, since 2007, 2008, someone on our borders who was, shooting rockets every now and then at people in the South and sending kids into their shelters? And why did we think that was morally acceptable? Right? Like, didn't we recognize that? Like, as we said back then, they were like ISIS as well, just we were able to prevent them from committing those types of atrocities. And so, I do think there's going to be some form of moral accounting there. And I think as well about how we fought in some of the operations in 2008, 2012, 2014, if maybe we weren't, didn't act in a decisive enough manner then. And I think that's going to have to be part of the moral reckoning as well, but after this war.
So I want to raise, you discussed a primary law that appears in Sefer Tevarim about the laws of warfare, siege warfare, et cetera. I want to raise some stories from Tanakh, which might point another direction. I want to push you a little bit, and I want to, play devil's advocate here for a moment. We have the well-known story about Shechem, about Shimon and Levi, who after Dinah, their sister, is raped in, and this is in Sefer in Sefer Bereishit. They go and they encourage, they make a peace treaty of sorts. All the men in Shechem circumcise themselves. And then Shimon and Levi raid the city of Shechem and they kill all the males in the city. Now, we hold our biblical figures. These are two of the 12 Shvatim. Levi, these are the Levites. They work in the Beit HaMikdash. They sing in the Beit HaMikdash. They protect the Beit HaMikdash. It's no doubt they are certainly exemplary in their behavior here. How do we, I mean, and they wiped out a whole nation after one of them had raped their sister. Is that not a precedent for the way that we should behave towards those who try to attack us?
So there's always a question about how to understand biblical narratives and their value there. In the case of Shechem, you're absolutely right. Some certainly do cite, you know, those passages, which might be a model for warfare. But I think Rav Gorin, amongst others, was particularly Rav Gorin, though, I think in the most forcefully, because it was so relevant for him, writes, and we should always highlight the fact that at the end of Sefer Bereishit, Jacob strongly criticizes Shechem and Levi for what they did. And he gives a very trenchant.
Yeah, but isn't he criticizing them for selling Yosef? Is he criticizing them for this particular act, or it's for selling Yosef?
Well, it's hard to, well, part of, I mean, they weren't the only ones who sold Yosef, right? So it was partly that, but it was also for their temperament and what they did. I mean, I think in, you know, Perek Memtet, that comes up there as well. So many, Ramban points this out and others point out, it's not clear in the biblical story as well that this was seen as a great model of behavior. And you know, I think what you have here is a situation where it is important to note we could learn from the idea of Shechem, this notion of recognizing the fact that at the end of the day, we have collectives that are fighting against each other. And so one of the explanations, by the way, of why Shechem and Levi did what they did is they actually just wanted to kill those who had done bad to their sister. But once they started fighting in the city, the locals started fighting back against them because the locals felt a need to protect their own. And then it became a collective warfare. And so there is certainly a notion of recognizing the fact that when you get to war, war is about collectives fighting collectives, which means that people are going to die based on the collectives, and you're going to have to kill other people on the other side as well. But I don't think that means that this is the model of how we should fight, certainly when we don't have to fight that way.
Yeah, I mean the Maharal, and we spoke about this a little bit in his commentary on this story, and I'll just share the screen for a moment. This is, I mean, it's a Maharal which raises, you know, a lot of questions. Let me just put this fit screen. Everybody could see right now. The Maharal in his commentary, the Gur Aryeh, which is a super commentary on Rashi, he says, he asks the following question. Ach kasheh im Shechem chata kol ha'ir machatu laharog. If Shechem sinned, why did they kill the whole city? And he suggests, v'nirali d'lo kashavidi mishum d'lo dami shnei umot kigon b'nei yisrael kananim shem shnei umot. He says, we're dealing here with two different national entities, Shechem and the sons of Yaakov. And the same thing is true whenever you have two entities facing off of each other, even if there are innocent, non-combatant civilians, whatever it is, this is a war between two people. It's a, you know, it's an us or them type of mentality. And on that basis, it was justified for them to, you know, to kill the entire city of Shechem. I mean, you just think about, you just see what's happening around the world today. And again, I want to push you here. All the Muslims in the world, they're all like supporting, you know, the Palestinians and Hamas, you know, unfortunately. And all the Jews tend to be a little bit more, less supportive. You know, you see all these Jews taking over Penn Station. I'm laughing, but it's really not funny. And, you know, and that seems to be how this plays out. I mean, what other option do we have than to follow through with the course of, you know, Shimon Vilevi in this instance?
So there's one thing to recognize that you're going to have sympathizers and you have supporters and that you know, nations. It's another thing to say that we intentionally go and kill them. And in fact, Rabbi Yaakov Ariel, in this interpretation, this Maharal says, the Maharal is only saying, justifying why there's so much collateral damage, if you will, of against the people, but wasn't saying that we go and intentionally attack the entire collective. And there's even a greater proof for this, which he points out, Rashi Weiss points out, and others point out, since I was anticipating you bringing your Gur Aryeh, I'm going to counter with my own Gur Aryeh, if you will. And this is a Gur Arya that's talking about Yaakov fighting. And we're told when he's fighting with the angel, and he's very concerned, right?
Rashi is concerned he's going to kill.
Exactly. So the Maharal himself in the Gur Arya explains that he was afraid that there are going to be those who are coming to fight him amongst Esav, who were just hired hands and didn't really want to kill him. And he was going to have to kill them, but he was afraid maybe that's not a loud form of fighting war. And because those people didn't really hate him, they just were hired hands, they were mercenaries. And so he suggests that the Yaakov himself was afraid. And what God tells him is, listen, at the end of the day, if they're coming to fight you, you got to kill them and don't worry about it. Now, that would seem to imply, and there are other midrashim about this, about Yaakov and Avram as well, that the forefathers themselves were worried that they shouldn't kill when it's not necessary. And so I tell people, I've had students, I taught Yeshiva Hesder for many years, and I tell students, right, you are fighting a good fight, you're fighting ethically. If you have to kill, you have to kill, right? Chazak ve'amatz. But nonetheless, right, know that you're within an army that fights in a way where, when possible, we try to avoid, right, killing non-combatants, and we certainly should only target combatants. And someone raised the question in the, the notes here. They mentioned that it seems in one of the fights, Hamas sent out like 100 women and children, right, to sort of be human shields, like literally human shields in that case. And what should we do? And the answer in my mind is, if, well, if Israeli soldiers were endangered in such a situation, right, they have to shoot. They have to protect themselves. And if that means that they should be targeted, right, if that means that women and children are going to be killed in those circumstances, that is a tragic phenomenon. Now, it's not exactly clear what happened in that situation. The details are a little bit murky. Only YNET actually published it, a lot of that. I'm not sure why. But, I guess over time we'll find out why. But 100%, we cannot allow them to use human shields
Yeah,
to kill
I mean,
them.
one of my biggest questions, and something I've really struggled with, is, everyone wants to distinguish between the Palestinians and the Hamas. And the Palestinians are good, and Hamas is bad, and they've sort of taken over, Gaza and et cetera. But we know that Hamas is not. They don't just have 40,000 fighters. They have people who are supporting them in many other ways. The mothers who are cooking food for their fighters, and the people giving supplies, and all these other people who are involved in their ma'arechet, their whole system, who may not be carrying a gun, but they're very supportive. And when what happened on October 7th happened, they were on the street celebrating. And is that person a non-combatant? Is that person an innocent civilian? And that's where I really struggle with this, about how involved do you need to be to then be considered, and a combatant, even if you don't carry.
Right, so you use two terms there that I think are important. One is, you said, what makes him a non-combatant, and the second is, what makes him innocent. Chafim mipesha in Hebrew, right? I don't care if they're innocent. I care is, do they represent a threat to us? Are they actively engaging and assisting the army in a way that's harming us? Okay, so they don't have to be doing holding a gun to become a combatant in my mind, right? But if you're just sending up chuparim, and baking goods for the Hamas soldiers, I don't think that makes you a non-combatant. I don't know if that makes you innocent, but I don't know if that means you lose your non-combatant status there. And that's what I really care about, is that our focus should be on targeting those who represent a threat to us, who are actively guiding and assisting the military effort against us. Those people are all legitimate targets, in my mind.
Okay, so I want to open up for those who want to ask questions. You could write in your questions to the chat group. Okay, someone already asked a question about these human shields, 100 women and children. I see another question here from David Cheeger. Do Jewish soldiers ever have to put themselves at just have a block here, I guess, at risk to help the enemy? Sorry,
Enemy civilians.
to help the enemy civilians. Any thought about that, Rabbi Brody?
Sure. So if we felt that we never have to risk any soldiers, we would just carpet bomb. Just carpet bomb and wipe things out and say, listen, we're not willing to risk any soldiers. By the way, this was a critique of NATO, but you might say this was justified when NATO fought its humanitarian war, so to speak, in the 90s, Bosnia and other places. So they were very, very hesitant putting troops on the ground, right, putting boots on the ground, and they flew high as well, which increased the number of non-combatant casualties as well. So there is always this question about how much you have to risk your own soldiers. And I think that in any case, in order to win this war, we're going to have to be have boots on the ground. And I think that's very obvious because of the tunnels and other factors. So we are putting our soldiers at risk anyway, and we are putting our soldiers at risk the way that we fight. But like I said, the when push comes to shove, the error should be on the side of preventing our deaths. Of our soldiers' deaths. This is a massive issue in 2008, when one of the earlier wars against Hamas, where two prominent Zionists and military ethicists, Michael Walzer and Avishai Margalit, published an article in which they said it's true about Afghanistan and other places as well, that Israeli soldiers need to put themselves at greater risk in order to prevent deaths of non-combatants. And there's pushback on this issue from Hasak Kasher here in Israel and others as well, who said, yes, there's some level of risk. When push comes to shove, we need a favor of force protection. I think that's correct. We need a favor of force protection.
Does anyone else, would anyone else like to raise some questions or comments? You could unmute yourself if you want to ask the question.
Yeah,
Any
go
other,
ahead.
who is that?
Mayor, go ahead.
Yes,
Yeah,
hello,
yeah,
Mayor.
yeah.
I just, Mayor, before you ask your question, I do want to thank Mayor Vollman for helping to organize this evening. Mayor is the head of education in our shul, so kol hakavod, Mayor. Thank you very much for organizing this as well. So, Mayor Bechavod, what are your thoughts?
Thank
Tell
you.
us.
So I wanted to ask you about the media issue and the perception issue. Not so much from an ethical perspective or from a will they love us or hate us issue, more from a strategic issue. In other words, if we do things that will be perceived badly, then political pressure can be brought to bear, mostly externally, but possibly internally as well, which prevents us from achieving our military goals. And I'm just wondering, I mean, when Yaakov says, when Yaakov rebukes the brothers, not at the end of Bereishit, but immediately afterwards, he says, kind of, you've made me loathsome in the eyes of the other nations. And is he in some ways making that argument, saying, it matters how we're seen by other people? It does matter because, there's security implications for us in that way. Are there kind of further thoughts on
Yeah.
that paper?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's a big question. On a strategic level, there's no doubt it impacts. It impacts us the way our allies treat us. And you're right, internally as well. The way people perceive it, the war is also a big factor. But I think we have to be very careful about the power of images distorting our moral calibration. I mean, there's no such thing as pristine warfare. We try to have precise warfare right now. We try to shoot accurately and good intelligence and take into all sorts of considerations, but there's always going to be collateral damage. Not only collateral damage, there's always going to be mistakes. And in past wars, whether it's Hezbollah, particularly Hezbollah war in 2006, this was a big problem in Cana, but other times as well. As soon as there's a terrible tragedy and a bomb hits a refugee center or a hospital, wherever it might be, the world goes nuts and Israel pulls back or there's a ceasefire, wherever it might be. Friends, there's no way of avoiding those moments. Those are sort of inevitable. And if we're going to pull back every time, right, the world or someone gets upset because of the images, right, we're never going to be able to have a decisive victory. That's precisely what the other side wants. And so part of the message that we need to be saying is that the world needs to build up its moral fortitude. And this is why, sort of brings us back to what I started with. It's so important for us to have some moral clarity and moral fortitude right now because inevitably there's going to be these moments of moral complexity or of just mistakes. And we have to remember that just because there are mistakes and just because there is tragic collateral damage, it doesn't make it any less of a moral warfare. And so, Mayor, we do have to keep in mind, there's no doubt about it. But we also have to start stressing this idea that things and mistakes happen. And this respect, by the way, the shelling of the hospital or the hospital parking lot, which came from Islamic Jihad, but I mean, I'm happy it didn't come from Israel. I am happy about that. And I hope the world saw the type of propaganda that Gazans are utilizing. But it's possible that at some point an Israeli bomb or missile is going to hit a hospital or medical center or something along those lines. And our response there has to be that if it was a mistake, right, if it was unintentional, then we have to explain, that these things happen. We regret that, but it doesn't make any less of a moral war.
Anyone else? Anyone else? Thank you, Mayor. Anyone else want to raise a question before we bring our session to a conclusion? Okay. So I want to before we end, just another minute or two. First of all, I see there are a number of people here who have Chayalim in the army right now. Lawrence, is that a question for you, Lawrence? Go for it. Lawrence, welcome.
Hello. Just a different note completely. I don't know if this is. I saw a very distressing interview today, or a soldier said, he's so upset that he's so upset and so regrets that he wasn't around when he should have been around on October the 7th, that he hopes he dies doing what he needs to do now to defeat Hamas. He hope he dies because he tells he should have been around then. He doesn't want to. Is that a Jewish way of thinking?
I don't think so. I didn't see the interview. I didn't see it, so I'm not sure exactly referring to. But it's important for us, and this is exactly what we were talking about earlier about the way we talk and how we frame things here. It is deeply, deeply regrettable what happened October 7th. Not only what they did, of course, and they, all responsibility, blame lies with them. But what happened is deeply regrettable that we didn't defend ourselves the way we know how to. But nonetheless, it's important for us to recognize the fact that living is a value, and we want to protect our soldiers and our soldiers to realize that we want them to protect themselves, and we want to protect them as well. So I don't think that's a healthy, sort of way of looking at it. And for those of you that do have children, I have four nephews in the army right now, serving in all sorts of places, and it is a very nerve-wracking time. And we should know with confidence that our army, I believe, is fighting an ethical war and fighting ethically. And we should know that our loved ones and children and fathers and daughters and siblings, wherever else is there, should have God's protection, and they should have our full support.
Yeah, just to mention another story I saw today of a chayal up north who said, "Listen, I'm in the conversion process to become a Jew, not Jewish at this point in time." He's in and he asked the Beit Din to accept his conversion. He said, "Listen, I don't want to die, obviously, but there's a chance I'm going to die in this war. I want to die as a Jew." And and they sort of expedited the conversion. Because that's a real an awareness of identifying with the tzara, with the pain of the Jewish people, and that's a really important part of the conversion process. But Lawrence, the example you gave is, I think it's sort of unusual. We don't see that type of that sentiment, and that's sort of one thing I've been mentioning about Hamas in the last few weeks is that they're essentially a godless death cult, where they prefer to die, as opposed to living and achieving some form of peace. And they would prefer to kill our children than protect their own, and that is one of the core values that separates us, from them. And when that changes, when they care more about their children than killing our children, there will be an opportunity for peace. But Lawrence, there may also be an element of survivor's guilt here. It's possible that this
Yeah,
chayal,
I think it was. I think it probably. Yes, it was. It was. He said it
he
himself.
probably feels his best friends, his Ksini, whoever passed away, it was really, really hard for him. So we're gonna conclude here. I just want to conclude with a quick tefillah for us. We're gonna say this together. You could join me. Shir la'maalot mishaber chaletzal, and we'll end the session. Shir la'maalot esa inai el haharim me'ayin yavo ezri ezri me'im Adonai osei shamayim va'aretz al yitein lamot ragdacha Al yanum shomrecha. Hinei lo yanum v'lo yishan. Shomer Yisrael. Adonai shomrecha. Adonai tzilecha al yad yiminecha. Yomam hashemesh lo yakeka. V'yareach ba'layla. Adonai yishmorcha mikol ra. Yishmor et nafshecha. Adonai yishmor et yitecha v'oecha. Me'ata v'yad olam enada mishaberach v'chai v'tzahal. Mishaberach avotenu Abraham Yitzchak v'Yaakov. הוא יברך את חיילי צבא הגנה לישראל ואנשי כוחות הביטחון, העומדים על משמר ארצנו וערי אלוהינו, מגבול הלבנון ואבירה מצרים, מן הים הגדול עד לבוא הערבה, ביבשה, באוויר ובים. ייתן אדוני את אוהבינו, הקמים עלינו ניגפים לפניהם. הקדוש ברוך הוא ישמור ויצל את חיילינו מכל צרה וצוקה, ומכל נגע ומחלה, וישלח ברכה והצלחה בכל מעשי בהם. ידבר שנים תחתיהם, ויעטרן בחדר ישוע בטר ניצחון, וגויה מהם הכתוב, כי אדוני אלוהיכם ההולך עמכם, להילחם לכם עם אויביכם, להושיע אתכם ונאמר אמן. Okay, thank you so much to Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Brody. We look forward to reading your book when it comes out. Maybe we'll even get a little discount. You'll send us the code, we'll send it out. But please God, everyone should, my hope is that the book becomes totally irrelevant by the time it comes out. We shouldn't need it. We should have the peace that we speak about in Sefer Micha, Sefer Yishayahu. But until Mashiach comes, this is clearly a very important work that we'll study closely. I want to thank everybody for participating. Thank you, Mayor, again. Thank you, Rabbi Brody. And Bezrat Hashem, we should only have Bezrat Tovot, Biachad and Atzeach.
Amen. Thank you.
Okay, Kol Tuv.
Kol Tuv, Bezrat Tovot.
Okay. Erev Tov. Okay, and thank you to Selwyn Smith as well for helping to share this with other communities as well. And okay, maybe we'll work on something for the next for the coming weeks as well. I see some of you also have Chayalim on the battlefront, and we wish everyone should return home safely. Shetetzu b'shalom v'tachzeru b'shalom v'mehera v'yameinu, and very soon, and we should. We'll all see our loved ones very soon. Okay, Kol Tuv, Erev Tov, Marlene, Adele, Mike, Steve, and Karen. Okay, everyone should return home safely. Okay, we'll be in touch. Kol Tuv, and we're here for all of you at this point in time. Erev Tov.